Hello, Gwilym. How are you this fine sunny morning?
I'm very well, thank you. I've been out for my walk. I've seen some ducks, and there was mist rising off the lake in the park. It was very mangrovey.
Oh, fabulous. It's quite nice to wake up to a gorgeous, well, I guess it's the start of a spring morning. New hope on the horizon and all of that. Do you feel full of hope?
I'm a little bit full of hope. I've done one hopeful thing, which is to book a bottomless brunch on the 17th of April.
A what?
A bottomless, they do it in all the pubs around here. So you go in.
Is that like eat or you like buffet kind of thing?
Yeah, we replace eat with not eat, obviously. There's a lot of beer involved. It really appeals to the student in me. And yeah, theoretically, we would be able to sit outside again and do all that awesome stuff. So I booked it about 12 seconds after the dates came out. I thought it'd be quick, but I knew people would be on it fast. So, and I have got a table, so I'm very, very excited about that.
Lee Davis and Gwilym Roberts are the two IPs in a pod, and you are listening to a podcast on intellectual property brought to you by the Chartered Institute of Patent Attorneys.
You say you're excited about it, but I've started to feel some sort of like fear and trepidation about it all. I don't know if I'm ready to go back to being social again.
Have I mentioned to you before I'm worried about my volume control in shops? Did I talk about that?
Wait, speak to people as if you're on Zoom.
Yeah, I don't know how to talk anymore to real people. So I don't know. I walked into a shop and I was talking really, really quietly and they couldn't hear me because I've forgotten how loud you speak in public. So I'm nervous. There's loads of these little things. We'll be like baby chicks leaving the egg all over again.
I'm terrified someone's going to thrust their hand out and expect me to shake it. I didn't like shaking hands before the pandemic. So for me, it's been a blessed relief.
I bumped an elbow recently and even that was weird.
I hope it wasn't too painful.
It was just someone else's elbow.
Anyway, at least my jokes are getting a bit tamer. Great podcast lined up for today. We're going to be talking vaccines, which is a scary thing to talk about because I guess vaccines weren't much on people's radar until COVID came along. But we're talking vaccines and IP, which is an even scarier thing to talk about, I think, because, again, vaccines and IP weren't on people's radar until the pandemic came along. We've got two great guests. We've got Anton Hutter and Frank Tietzer with us, and they are going to take us through their view, their perspective on how IP and vaccines come together to make the world a better place. Anton, do you fancy introducing yourself to us?
Yeah, thank you, Lee. Mornings. Pleasure to be here. Thanks very much for inviting me. I'm Anton Hutter, and I'm partner in Venice Shipley's Chemical and Life Sciences team. I'm a patent attorney, and I specialise in biotechnology with a lot of emphasis on immune-related inventions and vaccines, and I've been working on a number of vaccines over the past 9 or 10 months, and I'm based in Venice Shipley's Guildford office in Surrey.
Fabulous. Sure. It's really, really great to have you on the pod. Thanks for coming. And Frank, how about you?
Yeah, thank you, Lee and Gwilym. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me. I'm a lecturer at the University of Cambridge and at the engineering department. I run a research group, which we call the Innovation IP Management Laboratory. In our group, we actually look at the role and how IP is being used and put to use in innovation processes and more widely in innovation systems. And when COVID came along, we started to looking at the different innovation activities that we suddenly all witnessed, whether it is the Innovation UK Ventilator Consortium suddenly being put together with new relations being formed, different companies that suddenly wanted to innovate together, or whether it's actually the vaccine development. So the vaccine as such is an innovation process. So we follow that with interest over the past years. And besides that, we have various other research activities going on looking at how different actors use IP strategically. But we're also looking in my research group at different technologies such as AI and blockchain technologies and how that will change the IP landscape and the IP industry in the future.
Wow, that sounds like we've got about 27 podcasts in there, Frank. So we may have to come back to you for some of those. That sounds fantastically interesting. Well, really great to have you on as well. So let's kick the show off with a very, I think, sounds relatively straightforward question, but I guess it's more complex than we think. And that's, can you give us some sort of overview or understanding of the history, if you like, of the patent system as it relates to medicine, and in particular, the development of vaccines? How does the patent system and the development of vaccines sit together?
So how I see it is actually, I mean, the patent system is one of the world's oldest open data repositories. So patents are actually publications and they serve different purposes. And the patent system as such has different roles to play in innovation processes and systems. One important role that the patent system has is actually to incentivize innovation and to give people some kind of, or inventors, those who invest in R&D, who decide to do so, give them an extra incentive by being able to claim property rights. That doesn't say anything of how they should behave and how they should be dealing with the property they are given in exchange for filing, for investing in R&D and filing for a patent application. So to me, the patent system, particularly when it comes to COVID and vaccine development and all the other, as we call it, crisis critical innovations that we have witnessed having had to be developed or where production have had to be upscaled to suddenly meet the spiking demand, such as PPE equipment. The patent system here has the role of an incentive to maximize investments that go into innovation. And that's what we needed in this pandemic. And then at some point, the patent system has also the dissemination function. The knowledge gets put into the public domain, at least partial knowledge. That's what was written down in patent applications. And then others can build on it. So these are the two functions I think are relevant in the context here of the pandemic. And then there's, of course, much more to the patent system.
And that second part is, for me, the fascinating part, because I think that's the bit that gets overlooked, is the fact that what you have there is this repository of knowledge that people can dip into and use.
And one point where we might come back to in later questions here is there is this 18-month period that typically patent applications are kept secret. And one could question in periods of crisis where time is really of critical importance, whether one might want to look at changing that for crisis critical patent applications, let's call it that way. But we really mustn't forget that the patent system was originally put in place as an incentive for companies not to keep everything secret, to make things publicly available. And thereby, it has a knowledge transfer mechanism into the public domain with that limitation that the knowledge can't be used for, or at least the owner, as it is with all property rights, the owner has to be asked permission to give for the IP to be used. In the same way, without the patent system, that mechanism wouldn't be available. And if you imagine Lee buying a new house, but you wouldn't have a front door, you couldn't prevent anyone from getting in or out. So the patent system, in a way, gives you, the way how I see it, is it gives you the door, but it's your decision whether you want to lock the door and don't let anyone in to your house to share the comfort that you have and offer a good coffee, or whether you actually leave it open and have a pretty open house policy and invites friends and families to come along.
If my wife was listening to this, she'd tell you that I often go out and forget to shut the door. So you've got me absolutely there. Anton, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think specifically when it comes to developing vaccines, for me, there are at least three or four clear time points in the research and development where you would be thinking about filing patent applications. You've got the early R&D stage where you do the initial biology and chemistry to make your drug and your vaccine, and then you'll do some in vitro or in test tube experiments, and then hopefully some experiments in some animals, maybe some pigs or rodents or monkeys, to see if there's an immune response happening. And at that point, you will file your first patent application. And I think that's also then, once that first patent application is safely lodged, then very often, certainly in academia, and I think many companies would also be publishing academically in journals. So although you've got your 18-month patent publication deadline, which at the moment is fixed and isn't brought forward, I from what I'm seeing, although that once that patent application has been filed, then the researchers are very keen to disseminate the information and the invention and aren't waiting until the PCT is published. And then you roll out your clinical trials and you see if in humans you get the immune response. And again, very often that generates new exciting data in terms of administration modes, formulation improvements. And again, you'd file your follow-on patent applications and you'd probably publish that again before your PCTs are published. And then you do your vaccine rollout, large scale, as we're currently enjoying at the moment, 20 million, is it now? 19 million, which is terrific. And again, more intellectual property is being generated. You'll hear on the news the difference between the timings of the first primer jab and then the second booster jab, although I think in the clinical trials they did, was it 3 or 4 weeks apart? Now there's this delay. And I heard last night that actually a delay can improve the immune response. Now, that wasn't tested and trialed in the clinical trials because certain types of immune cells are being triggered and the inferior ones are not being triggered because they're dying off. So without going into the details, that's very interesting. And I think that generates tier three or phase three of intellectual property, which will be patented and published. And then finally, once we've resolved the vaccine and we're happy with the formulation, then it's all about manufacturing and upscaling. And improvements on thermal stability. So you've got three or four clear time points in the generation of a vaccine when you'd be filing patent applications and probably publishing as well to tell people what you've done rather than wait until the PCT publication.
And if I might jump in here, I think what you said at the end, the upscaling and innovations relating to that, suddenly creating these massive volume, production volumes that we all need, that is an issue where I would expect at the moment innovations to happen and where we might then see later on patent applications, of course, when they get revealed. And I think we're probably all looking forward for the actual vaccine patents to be released in a few months' time to look at those. One thing that you said, Anton, where I think it is important to mention other types of IP here is you mentioned academic publications, and that's all about copyrights, and academic publications usually get into huge publishers who put them out and to often take over the copyright. And an interesting IP initiative that we've seen there is to actually make that knowledge available and avoid it that it sits behind a paywall was the Wellcome Trust pledge that they did to invite publishers and other agencies and funding bodies to actually make these publications and data set available, open access. And there's a huge long list of publishers and other associations who have actually joined that Wellcome Trust pledge.
So, Lee, we've got another 5 or 6 podcasts just been added to the ones that you'd identified a few moments ago. We've covered an astonishing amount of ground in the first question. Congratulations to everybody. And I think one of the really interesting points, I think, Anton, you began on this in a sense, was looking at the two of the big reasons for the IP system. And whether, I think there's been a bit of discussion at the moment about, well, we know there's a lot of anti-vax going around. There's also some anti-patents going around as well, because of these concerns about exclusivity and, as you would put it, closing the front door and so on. You do a brilliant job of reminding us all that, I loved your phrase, it was the world's earliest open data repository. And I think it's always worth reflecting on the fact that if anybody ever wants to know anything that's ever been done technically in the last 200 years, they can find it really, really quickly using a perfectly globally acceptable classification system. That's astonishing. For me, I agree, it's an incredibly important reason for a patent system. And indeed, don't start me on AI and how important it's going to be to make sure that we use the patent system.
Please don't start him on AI.
How important it's going to be for the patent system to be documenting some of the core technologies there. But anyway, let's get back to vaccines. Yeah, there has been some concern, hasn't there, that the patent system... or fears by maybe people who don't know quite so much about the system that the patent system may be used to block access to the vaccines or to control the prices of vaccines and so on too strongly. And I wonder personally whether it's a balance at the moment between the different aspects of the patent system that needs to be struck between the incentivization of research, and in the end, that's a commercial carrot, if you like, versus I personally feel the ability of using the patent system to make sure that people can collaborate better and ensure a fair reward. Mm-hmm. Do you think that balance is being struck? Do you think that government perhaps needs to step in and think about that a little bit?
What I would definitely say here is that, and we've seen some empirical academic studies in what is called open innovation research, so which is very much about different actors collaborating, often companies collaborating together. And I think that is pretty relevant here. And what those studies have shown is that IP really, really has a role to play, and particular patents are really important to enable collaborations. And that has triggered a large debate in the academic circles to actually say, how should firms suddenly behave differently, and how should they treat patents differently? So there is, as I said, the evidence that IP basically builds a bridge, and it's just only by actually being able to have these property rights in place. And I think we know that from very well-established economic theory, that for all kinds of markets, the allocation of property rights to different actors, a clear allocation of property rights, is really important for markets to function. And I think the same argument goes for collaboration, that by clearly being able to allocate IP to the different parties, that enables efficient contracts to be signed between the different actors. Now, it's not often actually that easy. The challenge comes with actually specifying the background IP that different players bring into a collaboration. And that is, as I've also mentioned copyright before, it's not just all about patents. Patents may play a key role, but there's also, there are trade secrets, there's other know-how, someone mentioned before, data, that large data sets can play quite a role. I think Anton said that when talked about the vaccination development process. So yes, is the answer, that patents and other IP rights really play a role to enable collaboration, so that different partners can really work out the contracts and the relationships, how they work together. And then obviously there are the issues about the foreground IP. How do you split that up? And I think there's more research to be done, and there one could really discuss that certain firms or maybe even universities have particular ideas about them owning all the foreground IP that comes out of certain research. And there might be different licensing models that we may need in the future, dealing better with future crises.
Thank you. I mean, so Anton, this question about whether the patent system is getting a slightly bad press at the moment, people are concerned about the possibility it can be used to change the pricing of vaccines or reduce access. Obviously, like you, I'm a patent attorney, and we tend to look more on the patent owner side, and our clients are all patent owners. Do you find there's a sensitivity and an awareness of that amongst your clients, that they're aware that they need to look at the public mood in this area?
Yeah, I think from the clients that I'm working for, particularly in the COVID area, which is detection, everybody wants to have a new diagnostic, a home mobile phone related app diagnostic to vaccines. People realize that for the greater good, it shouldn't be all about making money. And there is an element of altruism here as well, which is very refreshing. We know that in the press, at least three or four of the approved vaccines are being sold at nothing more than cost. There's quite a variety in costs, because some of them, Moderna one, for example, the messenger RNA vaccine was very expensive to make. It's very complicated. And so I think theirs is about $20 a dose. The Oxford and the Pfizer vaccines are just a small number of pounds. So if this were blockbuster drugs, these would be costing significantly more. So I think it's good to see that pricing at the moment, at least for this phase of COVID, for COVID-19, we're not seeing large prices being put on the jabs.
So I think, I mean, if I could go back here to one of my earlier points that I said about the kind of alternative to patents, and one of the reasons why the patent system was originally put in place is to incentivize sharing. And the fallback option here is that without patents, you can go back to trade secrets, or companies go back to trade secrets. And we mustn't forget that. And the reason why I'm emphasizing that is because I think there is still in various communities a lack of understanding what a patent really is. And as I said before, it is essentially at the beginning only an allocation of ownership rights. So someone gets an ownership title for something they have invented. And your point, Gwilym, was about the kind of bad press that might be around patents in the when it comes to vaccines, but maybe wider in the medical or maybe even in the humanitarian communities. I think the misperception here is, and maybe that would be a bit of a job for CPAR as well, would be to really clarify that to certain communities that it is more about the behavior of the owners of these patents that maybe has a kind of negative impact and that has created the negative perception of patents in certain contexts. So the allocation of ownership rights, but just giving someone a title does not mean others are not able to use it, but they just have to ask permission. And then it's up to the behavior of that owner of that IP. And things have somehow gone wrong maybe in the past by some of the actors, large scale patent portfolio owners or so having adopted certain strategies that may have shaped negative perception here. And it comes down to clarifying that and correcting the kind of, let's say, the negative connotation that a patent may have for certain communities. And very sadly, we have for one of our other research projects where we look into the relationship between IP and sustainable impact, environmental, but also social impact that it can create and how IP is being used. We did a recent interview with a French company. And what we heard in that interview made me almost a bit sad. But that story was exactly that company used patents and it was criticized for using patents. And then it reverted back to stop filing patents and keeping things more secret. And that actually doesn't help anyone.
No, it's a catastrophe, which is why, as I say, I'm worried about the AI side of things by the same token. It's quite interesting. Lee.
I've got friends, Gwilym. I know you might find this difficult to believe, but I've
got
friends.
Stop there. Stop there.
And occasionally I have conversations with them. I know that's equally as scarily unbelievable. they sort of know what I do, but they don't really understand my job. I don't come from the IP world, do I? I come from the world of education and professional associations. And over the last 10 years, I've learned a huge amount about the IP space. So they ask me questions in kind of real layperson's terms. So one of the questions I was asked, I'd like Anton and Frank's perspective on this, is I think people are used to the fact that it takes a long, long time to get medicines particularly to market. Lots of research, lots of development. And I've heard people say that, you know, it's the patent system that slows things down. It's a barrier to rapid innovation. We've not seen that in terms of the development of all of the COVID vaccines. So why was it different this time, or is the perception wrong?
So in less than a year, we've now got 4 approved vaccines and more are in the pipeline. I think it's important to realise that it's not as if the research started from scratch last January or February. Oxford, Pfizer, Moderna, they've all been working on vaccines for years. Way before the coronavirus outbreak. And I think the great thing about molecular biology, biotech now, is that all you need is a genomic sequence, a protein sequence, and that's what they got in the middle of January. I think the genome for this current COVID-19 coronavirus was released. All of the researchers grabbed it, and very, very quickly, in a small number of days, I think 10 days, you can then immediately create what is your initial vaccine. You just need the sequence. They generated the sequence to the spike protein. That's the bit on the outside of the protein that hits and targets the cell, the host cell, on a certain receptor. And so they thought, well, that's the bit that we need to be targeting for an immune response. That's the important part of the virus. And so using essentially, I'm simplifying it, but essentially a plug and play system, all of these different vaccine approaches, you've got the DNA adenovirus Oxford approach, and then the mRNA approach that Moderna and AstraZeneca are using. All you need is the string of letters from the protein sequence, and then you can very rapidly convert that into a nucleotide, which then becomes your vaccine and then can be injected into the rodents, as I said a few minutes ago. And then eventually, if you get the immune response in rodents and that looks promising, then you can roll that out, as we did very quickly, assuming it's the toxicity is low or zero, then that can be rolled out into the human preliminary preclinical trials. So yes, we have vaccines in less than a year, which is fantastic, but I think it's really a testament to how advanced biochemistry and the biotech industry has got over the last 2 or 3 years.
I've got a theory about crises such as the one that we're in, which is that I think everyone knows that crisis drives innovation. But I have a kind of vaguely researched theory that it doesn't create new innovation so much as finds a home for existing innovation. And the example I use is from the Second World War, where there have been loads and loads of work prior to the Second World War on radar, but it wasn't that important, and it was just a long-term thing, and then suddenly it became incredibly important. And as we all know, now we have microwave ovens as a direct consequence of that, amazingly. Anyway, looking at this aspect here, I'm going to go completely out of my technical zone here. I heard a little bit about the use of, I think it's mRNA. I think that's it for me in biotech. But I gathered that we might have been seen quite an acceleration of the technology there to maybe use that for some of the vaccines. Is that right?
Well, two of the vaccines are messenger RNA. That's what the M stands for. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So as opposed to DNA, which is what the Oxford vaccine uses, messenger RNA is the encoded transcript. So it's sort of halfway between the genome, the DNA, and the protein. Messenger RNA is that messenger.
And is that quite a new technology or a new use of that technology?
It is.
Oh, so my theory is right. Woohoo!
I think, Quillen, to your point about whether we really see like radically new innovations being developed in crisis, and I think the question that Lee posed about whether there are delays because of the patent system when it comes to vaccine development, I think the important academic concept that I can chuck in here is called cumulative innovation or innovation trajectory. So we have to look at those. And there are certain fields where, let's say, the IP landscapes or patent landscapes are really fragmented. And then again, it comes down to really difficult fragmented ownership situations, which come with certain problems to actually make things work. And if you have cumulative innovations that happen, let's say, in the electronics space, where you have various different owners owning different bits and pieces, and it gets really complicated, then we might have some, let's say, deteriorating, slowing down effects of the patent system. But in other areas where there are fewer actors and where IP is fairly clearly, IP rights are fairly clearly allocated to the different actors, and if then there is a willingness to collaborate and make things work, and I think that's what we've seen in at least certain sectors related to the current pandemic, is that there was really a willingness to work together and a willingness to collaborate together. And then things can make work, and then there's more than just IP to make that collaborations work. And over time, a number of incremental innovations stacked on top of each other can be leading to quite some radical different changes. But again, we shouldn't also be forgetting, as Anton has pointed out, that the mRNA technology was actually also has been developed for a long time before the actual COVID pandemic has happened.
Can I keep us on the sort of heavy science side for a bit, if that's okay? I won't pretend for one moment that I understand it all. I won't. I've heard phrases like spiky protein. I thought that was some kind of milk drink. But the one thing I do understand, I think, is that this thing's not going to be over quickly. We're hearing in the news all the time that probably we're going to end up in a similar situation to other things such as influenza, so annual boosters. We might see new strains of coronavirus that will require either modified or new approaches to vaccination. What are the IP implications there?
So I think every year we will see new outbreaks and new variants, and some of these variants will be protected by existing vaccines. But for me, it's inevitable that the evolution of the viruses are clever little things. You have to have a certain amount of admiration for them, I'm afraid to say, because they are so simple, and all they want to do is breed and they need a host to be able to do that. And unfortunately, we are the host. So they will evolve with only one MO, and that is to improve its chances of infecting a different host and or improving its rate of division. It's not in its interest, evolutionary speaking, to kill its host. So I think that's something that you have to bear in mind. Obviously, the number's not good at the moment, but I think it will evolve. And in a few years' time, and I can't say if it's next year or the year after, but today's vaccines will not vaccinate us as well as they are today. I mean, the numbers that we're seeing on efficacy are fantastic. 85, 90, 95%. These are unheard of if you think that the current influenza vaccine is only about 50 or 60% efficacious. But that said, I think in a few years' time, we will have to have a new vaccine. I think we will need annual jabs or perhaps jabs every 2 years as we do influenza. And the future virus that we will be immunizing against will not be the same virus that we're immunizing against today. The spike protein will have changed in some way. And so I think new patent applications will be filed to these new variants. Whether or not they're novel and inventive, the criteria for patentability remains to be seen. But I think the innovators will have new products, new vaccines, new formulations, new methods of manufacturing these new vaccines. So there's a whole host of potential intellectual property there that may well be protected.
Yeah, and I mean, I've mentioned this academic concept of cumulative innovation. Now, there's another one, which is called continuous innovation, right? And that's what we need. We will, in order to cover the new variants with vaccines, they will have to be developed further. So there needs to be further investments, need to be channeled into research to understand also, maybe not just to be reactive to the changing different types of the spike protein, but to understand how that process works, and there will be more research being funneled into it. And then again, we have that dilemma, which it comes down to, that we have to maximize investments, and that's where patents are one of the mechanisms to do that. But at the same time, we have to make it available as to the public, and there's the big debate about access to medicine. And somehow the original mechanism of the patent system to get maximum 20 years kind of protection, that can be debated. Obviously, if we wait for 20 years for the new technologies to be available, then the virus will be up and away and massively in front of us. So we will have to maybe think more about how whether there are any new mechanisms that we can really develop, that we maintain the incentive mechanism of patents to maximize investments and continuous our investments to address the changes of COVID virus. But at the same time, we have to think about how we still, while we maintain that investment incentive, how we could still come up with ways to share that IP. And there are existing mechanisms. As you all are aware, the compulsory licensing or crown use is one of them, but that has never really been triggered because it comes with severe implications on the kind of market. And as we all know, trust plays a big role in industry. So we may have to think about other mechanisms there to kind of get hold of that dilemma. We have to maximize investments where patents play a good role, but also making this available. Maybe some softer forms of these kind of compulsory licensing regimes. There are also patent pools, but we also know from the past that setting up patent pools are extremely difficult and often takes a good amount of negotiations between different partners, and that could be a lengthy process. So maybe that's also not a perfect tool in a pandemic where time is short.
We saw things like the Open COVID Pledge, didn't we, as well? So that was some collaboration levels there.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I could talk more about that as I've been involved in that one. I think the Open COVID Pledge is one example, but actually there are very other types of pledges, and I've mentioned the Wellcome Trust initiative to to kind of temporarily pledge copyright by making publications and data set available for the time of the pandemic. That's a pledge geared to a copyright. And I do think that the pledge mechanism is interesting. And we could, for instance, think about funding contracts, government funding contracts for R&D investments, including some form of pledge clause potentially in the future. And that could also be an instrument that could be used in governmental procurement contracts for vaccines. But that comes down to, again, in that comparing pledges to patent pools and compulsory licensing regimes, patent pledges are a fairly young instrument, and they are not so well understood. And I don't know to what extent really policymakers have really heard about patent pledges and if they understand what it means. But that temporary self-executing mechanism linking a pledge to an organization such as the WHO announcing a global pandemic and then ending a global pandemic, there are really good mechanisms that can be used to design clever pledges. And I think that's an instrument that we should be looking more at to help with future crises.
Sticking with the pharmaceutical companies as businesses model, I know businesses need to be profitable to survive. That would have presumably factored into the approach to developing vaccines. But I also know that governments around the world and charitable foundations and even private individuals have put money into the development of vaccines. Probably an unfair question because it's maybe off of our collective radars, but are there strings attached in relation to ownership of IP rights when you've got this multiplicity of funding streams?
It kind of links a bit to my answer I gave just a second ago. Obviously, I don't know that for sure. Obviously, lots of these contracts are kept confidential. But if I think about some kind of grants, governmental funding grants that I had for my research, there's typically not much of an IP related to it. So it comes down to the university IP policies to decide which way they want to go. But that's where I think, as I mentioned just a second ago, a pledge, maybe not as a separate entity like the Open COVID pledge, but a pledge clause could find its way in the future, maybe in governmental funding contracts. So to give you an analogy here, what the research councils in the UK are now doing, they are pushing really for research results that come out of research council funded projects to be made available open access, right? And that's a kind of requirement to make the published IP copyright available to the public and don't put it behind a paywall. In the future, we might not see that same with potentially patentable research results. I would not advocate for that. But what could still say that in these contracts, there should be like an emergency clause for pandemics or global crisis that wouldn't prevent the universities, for instance, to file patents and go for spin-outs. Because we all know that investors really are interested in the founders being able to say, we have a patent, and that helps them to attract investments again. But there could be that emergency clause in these funding contracts, which basically says you can do whatever you want. You can go for your startup. You can start a company. But in terms of a global pandemic, you will have to make the patentable IP available for the duration of the pandemic. But then again, we shouldn't forget that there's more than just the patents. It's often the complementary know-how that we need to actually enable the large-scale production facilities to scale up vaccine production as what we are needing now at the moment.
It's an extraordinary sort of scale-up problem, isn't it? That this must be something that we've never faced before in terms of the physical volume of medicines that we're needing to produce.
To your point, I think there are these two challenges. The one that Anton mentioned, it's there's continuous research that has to go into the kind of further development and adjustments of the vaccine so that it maintains effective against future mutations and variants. At the same time, the production scale up, but also then the global logistics to actually ship it around the world. So that is a challenge we haven't really discussed today, and it's subject to completely other story. But I think IP really plays a role in both of those. But again, patents are only part of that puzzle. And if we ask, for instance, there's this case that Sanofi is also now producing the Pfizer vaccine. And Anton, you may know more about that. But I think they have come to an arrangement there to make this work at the moment. And that, again, shows that if there's a willingness of the actors, then that can all be sorted. Patents, again, as I mentioned at the beginning, they allocate ownership rights, which is important to attract investments and be able to make certain decisions. But in a pandemic, there's much more that is needed in terms of collaboration, goodwill, and the willingness to engage and share and jointly innovate.
The other thing to bear in mind is patent applications. If the patent attorney is doing his job properly, it won't be specifically protecting only the COVID-19 that we're having to deal with today. So patent applications for detection of the virus, for treatment, for vaccines, for drugs and so on, you would hope that the claims of those patent applications are covering not just COVID-19, but other viruses and future pandemics and so on, or non-pandemics. And so to uncouple the pandemic and pressing urgent needs today and ownership of those IP rights from less pressing, still obviously important because you're saving people's lives. But I mean, how many patents are there on heart disease? And no one has a problem with those. Yeah. Or cancer, for that matter. How many patients are unfortunately dying every year? It's just because there's a lot of emotion, and I can understand it, but it's very emotive, this pandemic, for good reason. But I think we need to just separate the emotion and think about the reasons for the patent system that you alluded to a while ago, and make sure that we don't then dilute those reasons for the patent system and ownership and enforcement and so on for something that is, as I say, we're dealing with right now, but hopefully in 6 months, in a year, it will be the norm. I mean, I think we will have to have annual or biannual jabs, and we'll look back on this and think, oh, well, we got through it, and the patent system did work, and it actually fostered and stimulated the innovation, and that's why we've got 4 vaccines today. I think if we didn't have the patent system, we probably wouldn't be here having a nice choice on which vaccine we want to have put into our arm. So we have to be careful, I think.
It's been a brilliant podcast, and thanks, guys, for the opportunity to talk to you. For me, there's been some ups and downs. There's been some kind of hope for the future, but also there's been some talk that perhaps still lets us know that we've got a long way to go. Let's finish on the positives. So Anton first and then Frank. What are your big takeouts from the last year or so? What have you learned either from the kind of vaccine side of things or the patent side of things that you're going to take with you in and onto the future?
Well, I can be quite philosophical, if you like. And I think we do live in a capitalist society. And as long as we live in a capitalist society, we do need intellectual property to protect and encourage R&D. And I've seen that. I've been very busy because of some terrific R&D that has come out because of the knowledge that it will be protected by intellectual property. And I expect humanity will move beyond money and the capitalist society at some point, if a virus hasn't wiped us out beforehand.
I said keep it upbeat, Anton. Yeah.
But I don't think any of us are going to be around to see that day. So the system that we have works, and the naysayers, I think we have to explain to them why the IP is very important in medicine. And as I say, it's an emotive time because of what's going on globally. But let's just think about other conditions where people are unfortunately dying as well. And the pattern system is fostering. We have terrific anti-cancer drugs and other diseases being treated. So I think that's what the last 8-9 months has made me realize.
Fantastic. How about you, Frank?
Maybe just to pick up one of, Anton, you mentioned different types of drugs, and it is really, there are difficult questions around the pattern system. And I agree with you, Anton, that now we all the good drugs we have that save lives every day, or also to mention HIV drugs, it's very difficult to really establish whether we wouldn't have them without the pattern system. That's a counterfactual question and extremely difficult even empirically to get your head around that. But the point is we have them and the pattern system has played a role there. And I would go along the lines of what you've said, that probably we have them because the pattern system provides extra incentives that helps to maximize investments that go into the development of the drugs, and that helps accelerate that process. So one of really the big learnings for me has been we hadn't looked into pandemics before, but that has been really, really interesting to look at the pandemic as an innovation system or innovation process. And I think one of the really big learnings is for us to say there are different phases along the pandemic. And when it comes to vaccine development, we have that R&D phase, including the scale-up, where we have to maximize investments that flow into that phase. And then at some point, the narrative changes to and we all know that we can only end that pandemic if it's not just the UK or Europe or Western countries that are vaccinated, but it has to be a global vaccination campaign. So we have to make that knowledge transfer. And that's where we may have to think about new instruments and new mechanisms that are maybe not as strict as the compulsory licensing regimes or crown use, but some other forms of mechanism that really can better combine these two massive purposes that we have to kind of, and they can appear as a dilemma. So there's a need to build bridges between these two different phases in the pandemic. And as I mentioned before, some mechanisms that could be borrowed, for instance, from the Open COVID Pledge or from some kind of licensing constructs that could be, for instance, put into funding contracts could maybe help with that. And we need more research to really figure out how we can better handle that potential dilemma in the future.
Thank you. Gwilym, it's been a long time since I've asked you if you've learned anything recently. Have you learned anything?
I've mentioned bread making, haven't I?
Yeah, no, you can't do bread making again.
No, I'm sure I've said this before. I think on a continuing Anton's philosophical trend, but maybe broadening it even further, I think it's been quite amazing and heartening to see people aren't as bad as we sometimes make out. Not Anton and Frank. They're great. I mean, never said that. I mean, humanity. The jury's out on you. No, I mean, humanity at large. You know, we've seen amazing collaborative efforts. We have seen, I think, used the word altruism, Anton, and I think that's exactly what we've seen. We've seen huge collaboration. We've seen huge sympathy. We've seen misbehavior as well. And I think I've also mentioned that we've seen huge, great leadership too at every level. Everyone who's stepped up and dealt with all of these issues has shown leadership in a personal or professional or whatever capacity. So there's a lot of positives, actually. It's been a tough, tough time for so many people, but it's kind of reaffirmed a few of the things I hoped were there. And I guess that's what crisis does. About you, Lee?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. So aside from the conspiracy theorists who can kind of run off and live in their own world, I think the thing that I've not so much learned, but it's been good to see return, is the place of the expert. Because, you know, 5-6 years ago, we were being told the world was fed up with experts. I know that was largely rhetoric from a certain quarter. But that did start to bite, and people did start to sort of distrust experts. So for me, the big thing has been we needed expertise to get us through this, and we had to trust people to get it right. And look, they've got it right. And that's been a brilliant thing. So for me, the biggie has been the return of the trust in experts. Well, Frank, Anton, it's been absolutely great having you on the podcast. So thank you very much for sharing your time with us. Guillaume, it's all right to have you here, but I might need to start to look for someone else.
You've got to go and have conversations with all those friends now, haven't you, Lee?
Yeah, a lot. Do you know I actually made them up?
We know.
Well, we'll say goodbye, and as long as we don't get wiped out by some great cataclysmic event between now and then, I'll see you next week, Guillaume.
Cheers, have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Okay, everyone, have a good weekend.